I would like to introduce Elaine. I'm really excited that Elaine is going to be talking to us today. And a little bit about Elaine. Her professional career was predominantly in the insurance industry. And her bachelor's is in business marketing. And it was a perfect match for her expectation of continuing her career through to retirement. She loves sharing information and information.
And then Steph Jackson, who we call her the gut whisperer.
Somebody needs to mute themselves. Okay, great. All right, so she loves sharing information and inspiration to large and small groups, team members, and individual clients. And then marriage and children came along, and her training and love for education and assisting switched to homeschooling for 2 decades. So that's a great job, you know, taking care of kids and homeschooling. Her personal health challenges were a continuing thread, whatever she was doing, with significant chronic disease and other family members. And it all finally came to a head in around 2008 with her brother's cancer diagnosis. And soon after with her Hashimoto thyroiditis diagnosis. Excuse me. And so she found out that she was sensitive to gluten and the relationship between gluten and thyroid. So there was a connection between her health and her choices, and including food in particular. So she dove deeply into research from that point forward and discovered a completely different path for whole health. And the changes that she made started to have a huge impact on her health. And she was feeling much better, and she started to share what she was learning with everyone who would listen. So in 2016, she decided to take her learning to a different level. And so she completed her certification to become a health coach, and then decided to be a certified Dr. Rita Marie practitioner. So she's in the certification program right now. I think Elaine will be completing her certification in the next couple of months. So she is gonna continue her brilliant coaching and her support for ERC people as well. So with that, I would like to hand things over to Annette, and we're looking forward to your presentation on stress.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so I am going to share my screen and we will get this going. Okay, can you see my screen? All right, so if everybody can see my screen,
yes.
This is me. And what I'm gonna be talking about today is stress in relation to your health. So I'm sure that everybody has a little bit of knowledge in relation to stress, since it's been a constant thing for the last year, but I thought it just might be an interesting topic for what we're going through on the day-to-day basis, and particularly in relation to chronic stress. So as Lisa said, my name is Elaine Watkins, and I'm in the NEPT program. So let's see if I can make this change. There we go. Just to get started, just to remember that this is for information purposes only and for educational purposes, and it's not intended to substitute anything that might be coming from your medical professional, your doctor, in relation to advice, diagnosis, or any kind of treatment. So you always want to seek their advice and direction. And if you have any questions you might have regarding any type of medical condition. So what is stress? I thought it was kind of interesting, because if you look at a typical dictionary, like a Webster's dictionary, this is the definition of stress, or basically the ones that relate to our, as close as possible to our topic. So any kind of strain or straining force, like lifting grocery bags, for example, the intensity of such force. So maybe carrying 2 grocery bags versus 5 on your right arm, opposing reaction to cohesiveness of a body resisting such force. So you can imagine that, balancing things out and just opposing reactions to where you might overdo it or underdo it and they fall to the ground. And then urgency, pressure, et cetera, that's causing that stress. And of course, that's according to Webster's dictionary. So, but let's get into the mindset of stress without going too far here. So this is a picture of a very dark and potentially risky alley. So just imagine if you were walking down this alley by yourself and say it's in, I don't know, Chicago, Illinois, and you're not really familiar with your surroundings. You're all by yourself and all of a sudden you hear footsteps behind you. And then you start noticing things changing. Maybe you notice that your heart is pounding a little bit forcefully in your chest. Maybe it's speeding up. Maybe you start feeling clammy in your hands. You start hearing things just on an excited, more in tune level, things like that. You start noticing changes like that. And then all of a sudden you hear a voice that you recognize. It's your best friend and she's walking up behind you, and you then realize that you are safe and everything is okay. So that is a quick reference to stress. In health, we have experts that reference stress, and they call it, for example, with Dr. Datis Karazian from his book in relation to Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms, his statement that the biggest factor is stress when looking at the root that makes up an autoimmune disease. Or Dr. Kelly Brogan in her A Mind of Our Own or Your Own, and she says the impact of everyday life and experiences have not only on our emotional well-being, but also on our physical health. And then last but not least, Dr. Tom O'Brien, his definition of stress is coming from an environmental exposure such as pollution, chemicals, radiation, and low quality nutrient poor foods to the stresses of our everyday lives, including dealing with not feeling. Stress has become such an ingrained part of our day that it's no wonder our microbiomes are such a mess. So just in those three definitions of stress alone, you can see that they're talking about it from a wide array of focuses, where Dr. Kelly Brogan, who's a psychoneuroimmunologist, she's looking at it from a psychiatric perspective in many ways. You probably know Dr. O'Brien when he's talking about gluten, for example, or the autoimmune disease and its relationship to an unhealthy gut specifically, or just autoimmune as the topic itself. And of course, Dr. Karazian, he's talking about autoimmune from his book. He's focusing on thyroid, but sometimes he's also focusing on brain function and the HPA axis and things like that. So they're all sort of circling around the same topic, but they each have a slightly different definition that I thought was a little interesting and I thought I'd share. Now let's look at stress from a different perspective, not imagining you're walking down an alley this time, but imagining what your normal daily choices and experiences might be. So obviously to somebody that you might be sitting down at the table with, say maybe you're driving in the car with a friend and y'all are trying to figure out where to go eat, and that person wants to go to McDonald's or maybe a Krispy Kreme or something like that. And in relation to this particular example, and you need to imagine when you eat that type of a food, for example, what it's doing in your gut and the stresses that it's causing there. It might be causing you to be less functional, absorb less nutrients. It might upset your stomach. It might cause you to have constipation or diarrhea later. Might cause gas and bloating, all of those things. And this is, of course, just one example of one of the things that might cause additional stress. It's not necessarily like getting out of the way of an approaching car before you get run over. It could be the foods that you eat. It could be the negative self-talk that you play and replay and replay again in your thought life every day. It could be an overwhelming schedule that you tend to have overbooked on a daily basis and you have no downtime. Any of those can add to or contribute to stress in any combination, one or all of those and even more. So this is a picture, an older picture of Dr. Hans Selye, and he was an endocrinologist, and he studied the responses of the stressors, and he pretty much coined the term stress. He wasn't the only one that was studying it. They were aware that there was something that was going on that was causing different reactions that they couldn't attribute to certain things that they were studying at the time. So he continued. In 1936, he has that definition there, the nonspecific response of the body to any command for change. And this was on various studies that they were doing at the time. But he, his thing was about stress diminishing health and leading to glandular disturbances. And of course, he focused on that because he was an endocrinologist. And so that is the set of glasses that he looked at stuff through. He focused on non-specific responses of an organism to stress and various studies that impact, that looked at the impact of stress on the production of corticosteroids. He was the first to demonstrate the separation of a stress disease. They knew that there was something going on, but they didn't really isolate it. And he was really the first one to isolate it. And back at that time, they were calling it stress syndrome, or they might call it a general adaptation syndrome, or GAS, GAS. And that was right around the 70s, basically. 1974 was the date that I got, but it was right around that time period when where he and other researchers were looking into this. They talked about the HPA axis, which is the hypothalamus, pituitary, and then adrenal system, and how they communicate in relation to managing your responses to stress, whether a physical stress or a perceived stress. And he was the first to actually describe it in relation, of course, to your glandular system. And he also held the idea of two different, he called it two different reservoirs of stress resistance state or stress energy. One, which is one at that time, they defined as a superficial level, which can be restored. And then another one that was deeper. And they felt at that time that it could not be restored, that once it was permanently depleted, it was depleted. Anyway, he was one of the names that continues to be at the base of several different studies that continue throughout this time. And even Dr. Brogan referenced him in her book, Mind of Your Own. Nowadays, we've come to the point where we know about the autonomic nervous system and how it's divided in two separate systems. You have your sympathetic system, which is nicknamed the fight or flight response, or some people might look at it as the gas pedal, like you're putting on the gas to go, go, go. And the other side is the parasympathetic, or some nickname it the rest and digest, and you might think of it as putting on the brakes. So in the sympathetic nervous system, that's when you're confronted with a situation like a car. You're walking across the street and a car is advancing towards you and it looks like it's getting ready to hit you. And the responses, the changes that your body makes in the midst of that emergency situation, the response that you have to survive that situation. And in the parasympathetic state, that's where you're in a hopefully normal, more common state of rest and relaxation. You're just going about your day, you're conserving energy, your body is making reparations, and it's replenishing your bodily functions and system throughout a normal everyday process. So in that state, this is a graphic that's sort of simplified, but basically it's kind of a demonstration of how your body would respond when it receives data in through that first bar, which it's receiving information through your eyes or your ears or your thoughts. It could be your senses, to whether you're balanced, like if you're losing your balance, or any kind of sense that shows that there's some kind of threat, something is off. And so it immediately signals the amygdala, and then the amygdala interprets what that information is and decides what it needs to do. And then it will send a signal to the hypothalamus. And then, of course, the hypothalamus is your command center, where it's directing that body by activating your sympathetic nervous system. Oh my gosh, there's something going on. Whether it is legitimately a car coming towards you, or you perceive that there's something, you know, something wrong. Somebody is threatening you. Maybe you're replaying a bad event in traffic, for example, or maybe you had an argument with your spouse or a child or something, and you're replaying that in your mind, and you're perceiving it as happening right then. anyway, that will send signals to like your adrenal glands to release epinephrine, for example, adrenaline. And I'm trying to see where I am. Anyway, it you release these glucocorticoids, I'm sorry, and those are what regulate and function in this situation. And you have started this HPA cascade, you have an endocrine response, and it increases those steroid hormones, which are called the glucocorticoids. Hopefully I'm saying that right. And then that includes cortisol, which is probably the one that you're most familiar with. You might also be pretty familiar with the adrenaline, which are obviously all part of that. Norepinephrine and then cortisol are the three primaries. Anyway, all of those are part of that mechanism that changes everything to get you to increase your heart rate. It makes a bunch of changes. So like when you were experiencing that alley earlier and you noticed that your heart rate might have been increasing, you might have noticed that you started sweating or your hands were feeling clammy or things like that. It's activating those types of functions. So it increases your energy fuel by activating your glucose and fatty acids in order to give you the energy to jump out of the way of that car or to run if you need to, or to fight if you need to. Now, the next slide is what happens when you're, for example, either shifting from a stressed state that is like getting ready to get hit by the car, or you're perceiving it, like you're replaying that that difficult conversation that you had with somebody earlier that day. So those are it's going to shift back your eyes, your ears, your thoughts. All of those are perceiving and realizing, okay, that we're coming to an end of a stressful state, and you can start shifting or passing that message back to the amygdala. The amygdala will reinterpret that new information and will signal a new message to the hypothalamus. And of course, the hypothalamus, which is the command center, will then take that new information and direct your body to dampen that response start shifting you back into that parasympathetic state, that calmer state. It signals your adrenal glands and your bodily functions to start making shifts back into a more relaxed production and response level. And so, of course, the different functions of your body will respond and shift back into a relaxed heart rate, respiration, digestion, sexual function, all of those functions that are more normally, I hate to say balanced, but more attended to in their relaxed state. So in a chronic stress state, you have those, if you remember, you have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic systems. Well, in a chronic stress state, you either don't switch back from that parasympathetic state, or I'm sorry, from the sympathetic state to a parasympathetic state, or you do very rarely or for very short periods of time, and you just spend a large amount of time in a stressed state. You're almost constantly functioning in a stressed state. So if we look at what is going on when you're in a stressed state, you have an increase of your heart rate, your blood vessels expand in order to pump through more blood in order to get the energy like glucose to your cells and everything faster to get things moving faster. You have increased heart rate. You have cortisol production is going to be basically doing what we nickname a progesterone steal. If you've seen any of Dr. Lascalzo, she has that beautiful chart where it's the production of the different hormones, but with the pregnenolone, it actually redirects from making progesterone, for example, to making more cortisol because you need that cortisol in order to keep that energy store going so you can keep on functioning at that high rate, that expanded high stress rate. You also have your muscles are activated and tense and ready because you're in an expected stress state. So your body is trying to be ready to respond, whether that means you need to run from a tiger or run from being in front of a car. Also in the midst of that, because you're producing so much cortisol, you're producing less melatonin because they kind of work against each other. So with a high production of cortisol, you don't really produce things like melatonin at the level that needs to be done. So that's going to, you know, impact your sleep and things like that. But digestion is impaired because you have a lot of attention that is redirected away from your digestive process. Because if you're running from a tiger, you're not going to be eating. You're not going to be chewing food. It's not really a priority to be absorbing nutrients because you're basically in the midst of running from that tiger or getting out of the way of that car or whatever that situation is. And so much of the energy that might normally go to your digestive processes are redirected into producing energy and stuff to feed those systems that would help you run from the tiger or whatever. So those don't shift back. And then, of course, your respiratory changes. If you're in a chronic state, you have expanded blood vessels. You tend to breathe more shorter breaths. You're not fully expanding your diaphragm and things like that. And so that also keeps you in that sympathetic state. So it kind of feeds into that. Just the same as with your digestive impairment, you also have limitations on your reproductive system. You know, because if you're running from a tiger, you're probably not going to be in a, making a baby or whatever. So you don't really need to pay that close of attention to that. So a lot of the energy from that system is redirected into feeding, running from that tiger. So you throw off that estrogen, progesterone management. And of course, with the progesterone steel that I mentioned earlier, you have a lot of energy redirected from that progesterone creation to additional cortisol creation. And so, of course, that's going to throw off your hormone production. And then, of course, your HPA axis, a big piece of that is managing your immune system. And so if you have immune system communication impairment, just simply because you're focused on certain aspects of bodily functions that will help you with running from that tiger, getting out of the way of the car. So you're not really focused on the calming things that would normally be present or a parasympathetic state that would help you with your digestive processes, your absorption of nutrients that would help you to build a strong immune system, those kinds of functions. And so your immune system is gradually weakened more and more and more. Something else that I guess I said it earlier with the heart rate, because you know you have your expanded blood vessels and your muscles in your heart in particular. So you can end up after a prolonged period of time have an increase of cardiovascular disease just simply because you constantly are functioning in that heightened level with higher blood pressure, expanded vessels and things like that. So I don't think I said that earlier. So let's get to the next one. There we go. I just wanted to point out that there's so much research in relation to this that's really fascinating. I wanted to just point out these few. Dr. Mark Gold, now he is the one back in 1982, he is referenced periodically. I see him referenced in relation to autoimmune thyroiditis, which has so many symptoms, but a lot of times you can have supposedly symptomless autoimmunity in relation to thyroiditis and depression, even though it's not really symptomless. It's just you don't have the itching, or you might not necessarily notice the symptoms and link them to what's going on. But it's a fascinating study. Another one was, I'm going to probably ruin this one, but Dr. Stojanovic, she comes up periodically. Hers is really interesting. She leaps off of where Dr. Cellier started, and she just goes into the stress as the role in relation to immunity and autoimmune disease and how the dysfunction that's tied to that. She just mentions the restrictions of the lack of absorption of nutrients and the impact of staying in the sympathetic state and how it hinders your immunity, because your immune system is basically limited in attention over a prolonged period of time. It's really a good study. And then this other one I thought just was really interesting. There's several studies in relation to activity and stress, but this one I just thought it was really good because it's such a minimal amount. But from 2009 to 2015, they studied 247,000 people that had mild cognitive impairments. So that is basically precursor to Alzheimer's typically. And this is a study that was done in Korea, Yongsei Medical University, and it showed that just doing more than 10 minutes a day of mild exercise one or more times a week, you could actually have an impact on your cognition, your brain function, just by a little bit of that, because it lowers, it's technically a little bit of good stress to help with a lowered amount of negative stress, because it slows down that cognitive impairment in those people, 247 people. They showed, it stated as reduced impairment. It didn't give me a specific percentage, but I thought that was just so good because it's 10 minutes one time a week, and you can just with that little bit amount. Now, there were many, many other studies, and most of the time they showed, you know, daily exercise. It didn't have to be difficult exercise. It could be just a walk around the block. It could be a short jog. It could be yoga. It didn't have to be a significant amount of activity, but it was just basically any type of activity. And this one, I just thought it was so impressive because it was just anything over 10 minutes, one time a week. And it's like, wow, it doesn't really take a lot, but just a little bit, you know, can really make a difference on the stress level and how your brain is functioning in relation to your normal everyday function. So where does stress come from? Obviously physical, because you could, you know, fall and injure something, and that's an automatic stress. You know, like I mentioned earlier with that study where you're doing physical activity, some kind of walking or running, that in and of itself is a stress. It's a positive stress that can be taken to the excess and turn into a negative stress. Your lifestyle, and that could really include a wide range of things, but that could be, you know, how you approach your scheduling and whether you typically have your day where you're doing back-to-back meetings or you're in a job that you don't like, or maybe, you know, you're dealing with difficult people on a daily basis and you don't have a healthy way of handling that situation. Mental could be like, for example, the negative self-talk that you might be repeating to yourself. You know, the way you talk to yourself, sometimes people talk to themselves in ways that they would never talk to somebody else. So it could be just that negative self-talk. It could just be also, you know, worry and doubt and living in fear and things like that. Your environment, that could include the toxins that you're in your house. So say, for example, the air fresheners, do you use plug-ins? Do you use cleansers that are harmful and you're breathing in toxic fumes, or maybe you have molds and things like that? All of those are stresses on the body in one way or another, depending on what they are. And then of course they're cumulative. So, and then of course the obvious one is the food. You know, what kind of food are you eating? That McDonald's hamburger every day, or are you eating, you know, an avocado and greens? You know, what type of choices are you making? And it's not with the expectation of being perfect in any or all of these. It's the expectation of trying to focus on, you know, moving in the right direction as much as possible. So some examples of things that might be triggering a stress response in some way. So if you look at these challenging relationships, you know, without boundaries, maybe you have a blood sugar challenge because, oh, you can't live without your Coke. You have to have your Coca-Cola every day, or maybe it's four or five Coca-Colas every day, or chocolate. You know, chocolate is reported to have some healing properties, but if you're eating, you know, like a whole bar of milk chocolate that's loaded in sugar on a daily basis, well, that, you know, is not necessarily good for you. Your food choices, as we already talked about, your immune system challenges, and that could just simply be because maybe you're fighting, some kind of underlying chronic infection, and that is inhibiting your immune system over a long period of time, which of course is going to impact your stress level. toxicity. We talked about heavy metals. That could be the stuff in, on your teeth, could be molds in your house or other problem chemicals. Or another one is if you're obese, if you're not at a healthy weight for your height and everything. Late bedtime. So your circadian rhythm is compromised to where, say, for example, today you're going to go to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and then, you know, you're going to wake up at 4 o'clock and you have to get started with your work. And then the next night you go to bed at 10 and your sleep is all over the place and you don't really sleep consistent amount of hours. And you oftentimes sleep fewer hours than what your body really needs. And then of course, during sleep, you're detoxifying and you're replenishing and you're rebuilding for that next day. And if you don't allow yourself that time to do that, that's going to hinder your function and induce stress. And of course, trauma, you know, if you're involved in a car accident or if you have a death in the family or if you experience, you know, a flood in your house or any type of trauma, unknown food issues. So maybe even if you're eating really healthy foods or not, but you're including foods that cause problems for you. So maybe if you are eating gluten all the time and you have celiac, you have issues with gluten sensitivity, or maybe you have a problem with oxalates and you eat oxalates all the time. Another thing is a common problem is anemia and all the different kinds of anemia. You know, there's several of them, but that can, it really any kind of a health challenge can cause you to have a heightened level of stress. Also grief is something that I've gone through recently just simply because I lost a close member of my family recently and just processing that grief and the stress that came with that. You know, that, you know, a lot of times people have significant loss in their family or, you know, in their life in some way and they don't move forward with that grief. They don't move forward. They become stuck. And that is a stressor that can inhibit your health. It can, you know, draw out a diagnosis eventually, you know, like an autoimmune issue, because that can become that last nail that creates that explosion of health issues that can get you that Hashimoto's diagnosis, for example, or whatever it is. So we talked about sleep quality and quantity earlier. And then, of course, overloading your schedule or having over expectations for yourself. So what I mean by that is basically you're trying to live a life to where you want to be perfect. You're trying to be absolutely perfect in everything that you cook, everything that you do at work, everything that you do at home. Maybe having all of the knowledge about one particular subject, like stress, for example, or, you know, anything like that. You kind of have a perfection kind of an expectation on yourself, which is just asking too much. You know, another one is inflammation and injuries and infections, which we've touched on these before. Inflammation is just going to be a problem no matter what, because that's going to affect how your brain communicates within itself, as well as the way it communicates with other functions of your body. So that's always an inhibitor. Okay, so ways to evaluate stress. Paying attention, basically. You can live your life every day and some of the things that you might have going on in your body or just in your life, you realize, wow, I think I'm overloading myself on my schedule this week. Paying attention to things like that. Also, a lot of times you might not necessarily notice it. So if you get a tracker and write down or log it on your phone or however it is that you are most comfortable with tracking, but paying attention to what you're doing and when you're doing it, when you notice you have problems, you know, write down the things that you're doing, whether it's relating to what you're eating, what time you get up and go to sleep, how much physical activity, I mean, you know, real physical activity do you have, whether you're going to the bathroom and how that goes, how that is going, how much water you're taking in or not taking in. You know, tracking it. It's really interesting. We tend to think we're doing a certain thing, but then when we start writing it down or tracking it, we realize, oh my gosh, I'm only getting half of the amount of water that I probably need. Or wow, I go for days without eating greens, or, you know, different things like that we might not necessarily notice just simply because we are very, you know, focused on whatever we have going on our schedule or, you know, work or whatever it is that's going on. And we just don't pay attention to those things and they can be easily missed. Seeking help. So this would be something like going to see, you know, scheduling appointments with Dr. Lascalzo's, you know, joining a program, and, you know, seeing somebody that somehow relates to what you're wondering about, particularly if there's somebody that's in like a whole health direction, they're going to ask you tons of questions. They're going to ask you to fill out questionnaires. And lots of times they're going to ask questions you might not necessarily think about, but they're going to relate back to some function of digestion or a function of sugar balancing or whatever that could back up to the foods that you're eating, the schedules that you're keeping, and help you to reveal the connections that you have. Also, symptom surveys are similar to questionnaires, but they might help you just to reveal the connection between some of the things that you're experiencing and what they might be tied to. And additionally, what suggestions as to how you can possibly correct that situation. Testing, of course, you know, if you go to the doctor and you get a physical exam, if you have constant injuries, say you have plantar fasciitis, you have pain in your legs, you know, that could tell you something. Repeated injuries, repeated problems with remembering or having brain fog or things like that, that's going to be symptoms and signals for that practitioner to make a connection and start examining different levels a little bit deeper and kind of back you out and to see what that might be connecting to. And then of course, labs like your blood tests, your thyroid panels, things like that, those are going to reveal different pieces of information that might tie into what's going on. Okay, so suggestions. This one is just really simple things that you might not, they're not really huge deals, but they're simple things that you can do that you can control and really make a huge impact on your overall health. So obviously this is just a drop in the bucket of things that you can do, but hopefully it gives you a good example of things that you can do, looking at your sleep time, looking at your circadian rhythm and seeing, you know, tracking it, doing this sleepcation that Dr. Lascalzo has talked about in the past and, you know, taking a few days where you can just sleep naturally without the use of an alarm and see what time you naturally wake up and then back that up to where you can set yourself up for a successful night's sleep to where you're getting plenty of rest. You can enter into a deep sleep and you can do that consistently. And of course, stabilizing your gut health and your blood sugar, because the blood sugar is, you know, obviously going to affect different issues. Gut health is going to affect things like hormone production and gut health. And the more you can eat a nutritionally balanced diet and things like that to heal any issues that you might have with that. And then of course, increasing your nutrient density, because if you're shifting from, say, a standard American diet to a nutrient dense, like a real food diet in a way that particularly nourishes you, then you can attack that stress just because you're absorbing nutrients and it helps you to unbusy your brain, not automatically go in to a function of not being so calm. You won't be prone towards brain fog, anxiety, worry, things like that. It helps you to have the nutrients that you need to function in a more calm and parasympathetic state. Of course, looking at life positively, instead of having negative self-talk, then reevaluating what you're saying to yourself, and just the way you look at life, the way you look at everything around you, and choosing to pay attention to those things that are huge opportunities for gratefulness. You know, the fact that you have a home, that you have a bed to sleep in, that you have the choice to eat good food and drink, you know, good water, that you have, you know, beautiful trees around you and you know, just beautiful people around you, that, you know, you have people that show kindness in your life and contribute to you. in your life, you know, just joyful things, the ability to create, the ability to use your hands. It doesn't have to be big, you know, it can be, you know, big and small, but just choosing to focus on those things and not be overwhelmed by, you know, the struggles that are obviously in life. There are challenges in our world that we can either hyper-focus on those or be aware of those, but choose to be more focused on the beauty and the blessings in our life. Then also with looking at your schedules, evaluating those and seeing what is it that you would want to alter. Is there a way that you can incorporate opportunities to potentially shift? You know, say for example, if you're at work and you have a stressful job and maybe you're on the phone all the time. So what about if there's something that you can do between phone calls? You can hang up that phone and take a sip of water and then do a slow breath moment before you pick up the phone to make the next call. You know, incorporating opportunities to chill out for just a moment, whether it's something like a breathing technique, maybe it's getting up and going for a walk, you know, every hour or, you know, whatever it is that your schedule will allow, anything that you can incorporate to relax. Also, if you notice that you have emotional stress tied to difficult experiences that you're facing right now or that have happened in the past, even in childhood, you know, becoming aware of those, and that might be on your own or that might be with an expert in that field, and then working through that process and moving towards healing in that area in order to lower the addition of stress aggravation that comes from that and healing from inside out. And then of course, evaluating and rewriting your personal internal scripts. That's that negative self-talk that is common, that can be so easily turned around. Avoiding things like caffeine and alcohol, you know, excessive sugar, problem foods, anything that is a stimulant that acts as an excitotoxin in your brain, but it's just really not going to be helpful in keeping you in a parasympathetic mode. Also, I referenced training. Exercise and training is actually really good and can be a positive stress until you take it beyond a healthy level. And so walking, gentle activities like fun dance, maybe yoga, things like that. You know, they are movement and active, but they're not excessive. And they're safe for you wherever you are in your journey. Adjusting your balanced, adjusting to a more balanced schedule with regular breaks. So, you know, if you function with a planner, if you function like using an online calendar or whatever, you know, even going to the point of scheduling in breaks to make sure that you don't forget to incorporate relaxing opportunities. Also setting boundaries, you know, maybe you just, whatever it is that's best for you, whether you decide that you're going to restrict yourself to two activities outside of the home per week, you know, excluding work, but like you're only going to go out, you know, for one thing or two things, or maybe you're only going to do certain things that are, you know, restricting the number of groups that you're a part of or the number of activities, you know, whatever it is that you find would be your safe approach to managing your schedule or managing your control of what you have access to in order to enable yourself to support a parasympathetic state. And then of course, addressing any infections, toxic exposures that you might have, whether that's your cleaners, whether that's, you know, dental issues, it might be something that's going on in, you know, in any aspect of life, but taking care of those to the extent that you can. And then of course, considering stress management alternatives, those would be things, all of those would be included, but any type of additions that you might need that would help you in your personal life that would be helpful. Now that could get into, say, for example, going into a counselor and talking through, say, childhood trauma, working through that. That could be any type of like a physical type therapy, whether you're doing like a Dr. Lascalzo's transformational recordings. You're listening to a calm recording before bed. It could be listening to gentle music, anything like that. Now, I would consider these, if you had to consolidate, I would consider these like the big things you probably wanted to address if you weren't already considering or in continuing to eat healthy and continuing to explore foods that are whole, real foods that support your health and support your sleep and support your function, your mental abilities and everything like that. Exercise at a level that's healthy for you particularly. That could be something like, it could be yoga or it could be jogging. You know, it could be anything that is safe for you at the health level and exercise level that you're at. It could be, it's really kind of interesting because exercise, there was even a study that talked about the adaptability of the brain to better handle stress because you're sort of preloaded in an exercise mode, and therefore it impacts how you handle stress. If you tend to be more active, you're more able to handle stressful situations just simply because of the way your brain functions. So any type of exercise that you can do that's safe for you at the level that you are, you might want to look into those opportunities. Thinking wisely, like for example, if you tend to have negative self-talk, well, take a moment to look at what you tend to tell yourself in your mind and, you know, pick one or two of the ones that are most repeated or the most difficult to hear, and then think them through logically. You know, it's like, okay, so if I tell myself, you know, that, I don't know, say if you told yourself you're dumb, okay, then you look at that, it's like, okay, let's look at this logically. Am I really dumb? So you have this kind of an education, you are able to function in a world where you help people in some particular capacity. It's like, just, you know, whatever level of analysis that you choose to take that, but basically just in thinking through that negative statement that you tend to repeat to yourself all the time, you're proving that negative statement false. And then you can replace that with a turned around statement. If you can either eliminate it or you can turn it around. It's like, wow, I'm actually a very knowledgeable person. And it's like, I can make a difference in people's lives, or, you know, I can build this, or I can make this, or I can do this. And, you know, whatever it is that tackles that negative and turns it into a positive and helps you to see that, wow, you're really making a contribution to society, for example. Also sleeping well. Sleeping is powerful, and it's just a huge thing. If you can get that circadian rhythm consistently supported and, you know, going to bed at a set time, waking up at a set time, and getting plenty of sleep regularly. Having enjoyable relationships in your life, you know, evaluating those that are, I'll say, challenging in your life, and then approaching those relationships in ways that would be more supportive, either by limiting your time with that person, if that's appropriate, or maybe it's just something as simple as having a conversation with that person about how something makes you feel, or, you know, how y'all can come to an agreement as to how you can approach something in a more healthy manner when that subject comes up. Or, you know, obviously that would depend on what that situation was and who that was, you know, because sometimes it might be a friend and maybe that person's been a friend for a long time, but maybe that needs to change and maybe not be quite so accessible all the time. So just to protect your health. Another thing is scheduling smartly and to include relaxation, which I mentioned earlier, where you would just take care of not allowing yourself to get overloaded, knowing your expectations and knowing your abilities. And that's going to change because you're going to go through different seasons and you're going to have different things come into your life that you can't control. But of the sections that you can control, what would be wise to do that would support your health and keep you in a state that would manage your stress and keep you in a supported parasympathetic state as much as possible. So let's look There we go. Some additional considerations that you might want to look into. If you're not already, there's all kinds of nutrients and herbs and oils that you can look at incorporating. Now, ashwagandha is one that's commonly referenced. Now, keep in mind, though, that if you have hyperthyroidism or if you have issues with oxalates, you need to watch out with ashwagandha. Lemon balm is another one that's really commonly accessed, and that can be really, really good. There's several studies that talk about how that decreased insomnia. It helped with people dealing with anxiety and symptoms of anxiety. Another one was Tulsi, and that's obviously holy basil, but Tulsi has also been studied just quite a bit, and there's all kinds of data with helping with anxiety, reducing stress and stress symptoms. Chamomile, you know, is another one that is great. Lavender is obviously good. Curcumin or turmeric. And that is another one that's very commonly used. And you can take that in a cap. All of these, you can usually take them in a capsule. They might be available in powder. Lots of times you make them into teas. Curcumin and lemon balm, and those are obviously commonly incorporated into food and your meals, your baking. Kava is another one. Panax, ginseng, and Siberian ginseng are both very, very good. Panax is really helpful for the HPA axis in the midst of a stressful situation or mental, physical responses. And then Siberian ginseng, they're a little different, but basically it helps with your brain and adrenals and thyroid and the communications between. And then probiotics, obviously you're feeding your gut, you're helping your gut bugs and supporting them in order to support you, help with your digestion, help with absorption, help with communication with other functions of your body. And then omega-3s, and that's in relation really to the, balance, omega-3s, omega-6s. But you know, we have such a diet that can be very high in omega-6s, so it's usually a good idea to look into incorporating omega-3s like flaxseed, chia seeds, things like that, that would support a higher level of omega-3s in your diet. And then zinc is always really good. Magnesium is really good. Also with relaxation techniques. Now this could be like a breathing technique, the one where you hear often, and there's different variations of it where you breathe in very slowly, to the point where you're expanding your diaphragm and then you hold it for a few seconds and then you breathe out even more slowly. But really, if you look at it, even the most simplest forms of breathing, they just basically point you towards not shallow breathing, but deep breathing, slow, deep breathing. Praying, meditating, that can be, you know, helpful in just getting your brain focused and calmed down. Journaling, you can journal your thoughts to where you're getting them out on paper and you can mold them and shape them the way you want to go. Something as simple as a magnesium bath or Epsom salt bath or even a foot soak to where you can absorb those, and you can do Epsom salt or magnesium. You can combine essential oils in that. You also have tapping, singing and humming. Now it depends on who you're talking to or listening to here, because if you listen to like Dr. Datis Karazian, he's talking usually about singing or humming loudly in order to activate your vagus nerve. And that also can go with gargling, but gargling aggressively, singing loudly, and you activate that vagus nerve, which supports your HPA axis. But it also can you can also look into, you know, humming or singing songs that you find pleasant that have positive messages or that have no messages at all. It's just, you know, instrumentals or stuff that cause you to calm down, to be relaxed, to be joyful, and just pleasantly enjoying whatever it is that you're doing at the time. Exercise and movement, I've talked about this a couple of times, but it's just something. Now it can be your more, aggressive exercise during the day, because that helps you in supporting your sleep that night. It helps you through managing stress, and things like that, but also even gentle movement at night before bed, like sleep yoga, things like that, that would just, you know, relax your muscles and draw your focus into being more relaxed as you prepare for bed. And then again, here with calming music and entertainment choices, this is just basically, you know, like if you tend to I don't know, watch the news or watch, you know, stressful TV shows or listen to stressful podcasts or whatever, those are going to agitate you and aggravate that sympathetic nervous system. But if you choose more calming options, at least, you know, more frequently, then that's going to lean you more towards supporting your parasympathetic state. Now, of course, I'm going to put massage on here because who doesn't like a massage usually? I think most of us like some kind of a massage, whether it's a full body or even a foot massage or a hand massage. But that's always going to be very calming, and particularly if they're using aromatherapy, you know, like lavender and calming scents, soothing music in the background, that's always going to help you with relaxation techniques. Let's see. Basically, I just wanted to have this here. I wanted to encourage you in anything you do to remember that you are your best health advocate because you are personally experiencing the combination of symptoms that you might be having, the thoughts that you're having. You are going to be the most aware of what's going on. And even if you're tied to, you know, a wonderful practitioner, you know, like Dr. Lascalzo, you know, you're reporting it to her, but, you know, sometimes it can be hard to get everything out in a way that, you know, she hears what you're saying. So you be aware of what you've got going on and then, you know, pay attention to it, take notes, you know, do what you can to support your parasympathetic nervous system and keeping yourself calm and keeping your stress level low. So you're supporting your digestion, you're supporting your sex hormone balance, you're supporting your mental function, your heart, your cardiovascular system, your, you know, all of your functions. And then with the help of somebody like Dr. Lascalzo, then they can guide you in the more detailed areas to help you to have an even more robust health. So I guess I'll stop there. And does anybody have any questions? Let me click out.
Thank you so much, Elaine. That was wonderful. Thank you very much. Very informative. Yes, questions? Put up your hands. Wheaton.
Thank you. That was wonderful. And I have all my notes. I had two questions. One is, if you're experiencing a stress, but perhaps you're not cognitively aware of it, can testing your blood sugar be a good window into your stress level?
Well, I know with some of the research that I am aware of, your glucose is pulled into your blood flow in order to support the energy to manage that stress. So it's my understanding that that's not necessarily going to help you to see that there's a, you're going to have increased blood glucose because you're dealing with stress. So if you have a heightened level of glucose in your system, in your blood, then that's going to tell you that something's going on. It doesn't necessarily tell you what to do about it because it could be in relation to your diet. It could be in relation to your thought life, but it's an informative lab. There's quite a few different things. Your salivary testing is really good. And you can see what is available there, but they can also tell your progesterone levels and your estrogen levels, which tells even more information. Your CBC is going to be really helpful, but it's going to be also one particular one that's on there is with your higher level of homocysteine, which can tell you that maybe you have a problem with absorption. Maybe you're having a problem with bees. You could have an MTHFR issue. There's quite a few things that could be telling you something is going on, and whether that is in relation to a genetic SNP or your diet or your stress level, your hormone balances, it all kind of works together. So it kind of depends on what test you have.
If I could just say, sorry to interrupt, if I could just answer directly, yes. When you have high cortisol, but thank you for the answer. When you have high cortisol, a hallmark of stress is having high cortisol. And when you have chronically high cortisol production or high cortisol production, it basically stimulates the triggers the release of glucose and actually triglycerides into the bloodstream. So what we often see is elevated blood glucose levels when we're having a lot of stress, and also high triglycerides or high blood fats. So those are directly triggered. Because if you think about it, you know, Elaine was talking about this fight or flight. When we want to underwrite our ability to fight or run away, we need to have a lot of, you know, sugar in our, or we need a lot of glucose in our bloodstream, and we need to have the fats as well to be able to give us the energy to run away or fight. But obviously it's not good for us when it's a chronic thing.
Yeah, and you're definitely pulling that from your stores in order to provide the energy to deal with that, whatever that stressor is, whether it's getting out of the way of the car or, you know, whatever it is. So you're definitely going to have that available in your blood.
Okay. And can I ask one more question?
Yep.
Sure. You mentioned the body using its ears and eyes as the first sign for stress.
Yeah.
This might be a strange second question. What happens when you're asleep? So your eyes are turned off, your ears are closed, but you have nightmares and you still have that stress that's brought on by a nightmare.
Yeah, because in that first stage, it's taking in the senses. So your eyes will see something, your ears will hear something, but it's also anything that could be perceived. So like one of the things, that your body is going to be responding to is whatever your thoughts, for example, and it's not something that you're seeing, but it's something that you're replaying from, say, earlier that day. And so that in and of itself causes your body to start reacting and send that signal. So it's all of your senses. I was just using the hearing and the sight as, you know, because you're going to see my car coming up on you. So I was just highlighting.
Oh, okay. So it can just be a delayed reaction. Yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, Catherine.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Elaine, for doing this. Couple questions. To get nerdy, which I love doing, you mentioned about the relationship between cortisol and progesterone. And like progesterone is a precursor of the cortisol. So if you were to take progesterone supplement with that, if you're already kind of in a high producing cortisol state, a high stress state, does that progesterone get then just raise your cortisol levels even more, or does it really supplement the progesterone levels?
Okay, I'm going to reference Dr. Lascalzo's diagram here because I had, I know I mentioned it in the discussion, but I didn't know how to pull this into the slide presentation. So this is the one that I'm referencing in case y'all come across that in your studies. And it's my understanding that if you reference that, it's dropping down from cholesterol down to the pregnenolone, and where the steel is going on is at the pregnenolone stage. If I understand correctly, then it steals from the pregnenolone and it goes over to the cortisol, which is, oh, down here. So if it's already progesterone, then it's already moved over here. So it's not going to redirect back to pregnenolone and then down to cortisol. Am I understanding that correctly?
Okay, so you're talking about the pregnenolone steel, and some practitioners debate whether it even exists, but I would have to say if you understand biochemistry or you see the pathways, it exists. What happens, usually, for example, if I have a Dutch test and that person has high cortisol, but they have a high need for progesterone, I typically wouldn't give progesterone because the progesterone would then be used as a substrate for making more cortisol. That's why it's called the pregnenolone steal, because it's stealing, it's not going down the hormone pathway to make the hormones, it's going instead to make cortisol. And once you correct the cortisol levels, then it's okay to give progesterone. I mean, probably a little bit of the progesterone will get to progesterone or to supplement progesterone, but actually probably it gives substrate for the body to make more cortisol. And so that's where having labs and having a practitioner who knows how to use the labs in order to supplement is a good idea. So it's not, you know, first step would be addressing the stress response, calming down cortisol, and then think about progesterone supplementation. Does that help? Does that answer your question, Catherine?
It answers it perfectly, Lisa. And I'm so glad you're my practitioner. Another question for you, Elaine, and obviously Lisa as well, is another biochemistry one, which is I've read that high cortisol levels can lead to muscle wasting. And there's some debate about does that happen or not. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't
answer that, Elaine.
Yeah, I don't know about the muscle wasting. I do know that in what I'm understanding in relation to the muscles is when you have the stress response, you have the change of the muscles because you're getting more blood flow into them, which includes the heart, but all other muscles. And so I would imagine if you have a continued chronic stress state, that's going to affect that in some way. But as far as muscle wasting is concerned, I don't know.
I'll answer that. I'll answer that. And sorry to interrupt. Cortisol is a catabolic hormone. So catabolic means it breaks down. So it breaks down our bones, and also breaks down our muscles. And when we're in a chronic state, we're talking about chronic state. So what Elaine is talking about is, you know, when we're initially running. So, you know, when we're having an acute stress, our body stands down, okay? But we're talking about a situation of chronic stress. So chronically elevated cortisol over time is catabolic. And our body has wonderful compensatory mechanisms. So as cortisol goes up, if our stress response or if our body's hormones are working properly, DHEA will also go up. And DHEA is an anabolic hormone, and anabolic means it builds up, and it's supposed to counteract the catabolic, the breaking down effects of cortisol. But when we've been stressed over time, maybe DHEA is depleted too. And then DHEA will not be able to compensate for cortisol's catabolic response. So oftentimes what we see, and we've got to be very careful about, is muscle wastage or breakdown and also bone loss. Those are two things that can occur on chronic stress.
Cool, thank you.
All right, next is Ronnie.
So, Catherine, you stole my thunder, stole my questions, kind of. It was actually along the same lines, although I thought that Elaine had mentioned something about the relationship between estrogen and pregnenolone. Or is it estrogen and progesterone?
I don't know what I said, but I know you're trying to keep the three estrogens and then the progesterones at healthy levels. And when you start messing around with the cortisol, that messes with your progesterone, which I don't know what another word is other, it's not really a balance, but it keeps it from achieving a healthy state or a healthy level of combinations between the estrogens and the progesterone in order to function and support your sexual functions.
I have another motive. It's not so much stress related, but it might be. I have another motive for the question, but if the estrogen is really low, so I was prescribed estriol and a bioidentical pregnenolone because that's also low. Like I don't have much anything. Probably got lots of cortisol. I was trying to understand what Elaine, because it comes up from time to time. So it's just like, I was just trying to capture what that relationship between pregnenolone and estrogen is.
Pregnenolone is the master hormone. It's higher up on this. So Elaine, if you can hold up that biochemical thing. So point to pregnenolone.
So pregnenolone is here.
Okay. And then point to estrogen. Estrogen is down there. So pregnenolone is all the way at the top. After cholesterol comes pregnenolone. And that's the master hormone.
Pregnenolone is the house. Does that mean that it helps create estrogen?
Well, it doesn't directly create estrogen. It goes to DHEA and then testosterone, and testosterone goes to estrogen. So, yeah. So you have to look at a hormone pathway and then you'll see.
Okay,
the estriol that you're taking is E3, right? So that's so you're taking an E3, which is the sort of the least potent of the estrogens.
Okay, so I'm also on a bioidentical testosterone cream. Mm-hmm, testosterone cream the estriol every couple of, like every two or three times a week, and a capsule of pregnenolone and their bioidenticals. Mm-hmm. And there was a concern about how pregnenolone works, because she didn't do the doctor didn't do a Dutch test. She's trying to save me money. She said that there's a relationship with estrogen and pregnenolone is what I thought. And then we'll test that in 2-3 months after I'd done the dose. So I was just trying to capture that.
Well, the hope, if you look at the hormone pathways, the hope is that some of the pregnenolone will replenish and just will stimulate the production of the different hormones. But estrogen is way down there, right? So it would be good if you do a Dutch test, and you can also monitor your pregnenolone levels in your blood to see how you're doing there. So, and then I would also see how your cortisol levels are, what your DHEA levels are doing. There's a lot to, you know, look at there.
So can you get that on a regular blood test? Like, cause she did, yeah, she did, can. She had a cortisol test. Mm-hmm. The DHEA came out in the normal range. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, she does integrative medicine. So, and I think that some of her information is old, like, but she's going by models, you know, I mean, it's like, she's going by some model that you guys aren't following. So I think there's details missing. And I don't, you know, honestly, it's like, I've heard the word estrogen, but really I've got nothing on it, Lisa. Like, I don't know what the heck pregnenolone is or progesterone, except that that men have progesterone and testosterone.
Well, we have testosterone.
I know nothing.
Yeah, women have testosterone too. So, yeah. So there's different ways of testing for hormones. Blood tests tell us at one point in time.
Yeah.
And then the urine test, which is the dry spot urine test, which is Dutch test, that gives us an idea about the metabolites. So we're concerned about the breakdown products of the hormones. So I would be interested to know what's happening with DHEA and the metabolites. You know, I would like to know what's going on with estrogen and the metabolites. So that's why we've used a Dutch test. But if you want to actually monitor how well you're doing in terms of the supplementation, are you responding? Then you could do a blood test and then check it every 6 weeks or whatever interval and see how your pregnenolone. You can check pregnenolone in the blood, and I often do that when I'm following somebody's pregnenolone levels and DHEA levels or progesterone. It's just a good way of seeing the responsiveness, you know.
Okay.
But I would suggest a Dutch test. And if you have a good relationship with the doctor, to ask her, you know, or him, I don't know if it's a him or her, and just to do some further testing. Otherwise, ask one of our coaches. We're quite well versed with the Dutch test.
I think it might end up going through. Even if it does go through her, she didn't think that it would really provide a lot of information. And then when I was talking to Dr. Rita Marie about it, or maybe you were on that, I don't know, or Valerie, I have no idea who anymore, sorry. But it was like, no, there's information, like the path, you get information about the pathways that doctor didn't seem to be aware of.
They may not know about them, and they may not have taken such a deep dive, you know, into them. So it's complex to interpret if you're not used to it.
And she's a good soul. Like, she wants to, you know, save my pocketbook, because it's like, if this gives me an initial, initial information, because Dr. Rita Marie didn't think it was that big a deal. It's like, okay, if you're only on for a couple, 3 months and then you're getting retested. But at that point, she said, you should get a Dutch test, because it's $440, you know, I'm in Canada, you know, might be cheaper. You're in the UK anyway. That's a completely different animal.
I'm in Switzerland, but in Germany we say Falschbaden. That means saving money for the wrong reasons. You know, you're not really saving. Are you really saving if you're just saving money? But are you really saving? You know, so you gotta just, I know, just. But I have a client who's in Canada, and she just got a good deal on the Dutch test. So I'll ask her.
Would you?
And yeah, I will. She's in Toronto, but you know, it doesn't matter where you are in Canada, you know, the post works everywhere. And it's a real easy test to do. But yeah, sure, I'll ask, and I'll reach out to you and let you know.
Thanks a lot, Lisa.
Monitor. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Lisa. Elaine, thanks for your talk. It's like you can see you're really going through your paces and all those details you're capturing. Good job.
That's great. Thank you. And Rob, you're next.
Rob, hello. Hi. Yeah, thank you, Elaine. That was a good presentation. I enjoyed that also. But I have another biochemistry question also. Seems like I have a lot of medical issues where it requires a cortisone shot. And recently, you know, I have frozen shoulder and I've already had 2 cortisone shots and I'm thinking about giving a third one. So my question, isn't cortisone related to cortisol? And when I get those shots, is it actually raising my cortisol?
Cortisone is a different form of a cortisol derivative, and cortisone is an anti-inflammatory. It's a steroid. So you know, as Elaine said, cortisol is a glucocorticoid, and so is cortisone, but it's sort of slightly different chemical structure. And what will happen is it's anti-inflammatory, and it'll suppress the immune response. That's how it works. But over time, you've got to be concerned. Because it suppresses the immune response and it can also result in muscle wasting. So it is a good band-aid solution, you know, but over time you can actually damage your joints or muscles. So that's because it has the same actions as cortisol. So as we mentioned, cortisol can deplete muscle and it can be muscle wasting and bone. So that's basically what happens.
So just where the cortisone shot is inserted?
Yeah, but it's going to work systemically too. You know, it's going to. So over time, I mean, 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 shots probably is not going to be a big thing, but over time it can really deplete.
Oh, wow. I've had 13 or 14.
So you've got to find out what else you can do and if there are natural remedies you can do, bring heat to the area. There's all kinds of, you know, natural things that can help help your shoulder release over time, as well as therapies, et cetera. So in the beginning, it's probably fine, you know, but just
do it long time. All right, thank you.
So Hedy's next.
Hi. My question's this because you just spoke about, you know, high cortisol and low DHEA. So I have the reverse on my Dutch test. Can you elaborate a little bit about that?
You have low cortisol, high DHEA, or what?
Yes, I have high DHEA and low cortisol. My DHEA on the Dutch test is 1,547.
Where is it on the dial? Is it sort of high on the dial?
Yes, it's in the middle.
Oh, it's in the middle. So that's in the middle. So it's not high, but it's in the middle. And then where's cortisol on the dial?
It's on the low end.
Okay. So the person that Elaine was talking about, this Hans Selye, he also spoke about stages of stress, stage 1, stage 2, stage 3. And we've come away from that in our work because there was actually not a lot of research to back it up, but it was a very helpful way of identifying where people were on the stress continuum. So in the beginning, the stage 1 of stress, cortisol is high and DHEA is high, okay? And then stage 2, which is a bit more chronic, cortisol is high, DHEA comes down. And then stage 3 is usually cortisol and DHEA come down. So probably you're in like a more stage 3 type of a stress where, you know, cortisol levels are, you're like burnt out. I don't want to use sort of such technical terms, but yeah, burnt out, and DHEA will soon to follow, you know, so over time. Usually DHEA depletes first before cortisol, but in your case, I think cortisol is depleted. What you need to look at on your Dutch test are the DHEA metabolites and where the 5-alpha reductase is pointing, where it is. And that will give you an idea of how strong your androgens are. So we females also have male hormones, androgens, and we want to see how androgenic we are. And you could look specifically at DHT, because that can cause hair loss in women, or you get hair on your face and stuff like that. So it's very
important. I have that.
So you've got to work on reducing DHT and reducing your androgen load. Yeah, so that would be important. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, and now let's see who's next. I think that's it. Anybody else have any questions?
How did we get to hormones and the biochemistry from stress? Elaine, what did you do to us?
Inspired us.
Everything goes back to stress, doesn't it? Or everything goes back to hormones, it seems like.
Yeah.
But obviously with cortisol, I mean, it's just definitely the stress is affecting your hormones. It affects your progesterone production and everything. So it messes everything up. So if we can just work towards containing it as much as possible, you know, and there's so many things that we can do that are really just, they're so insanely simple. We just have to decide that we're going to approach life in a way that's going to support our health. And in the long run, we might not be able to completely contain the hormone imbalances that we have, but we could definitely at least make a start, make a dent. And just choosing to prioritize your health differently, because oftentimes we look at our, you know, we're so busy taking care of other people, working in our jobs, you know, and all of that cumulatively slowly, you know, picks away at your health. And that stress just agitates and agitates and agitates. And so you see so many more people with digestive disorders, more people with hormone disorders. And so it's just like, that is one area where we can make a huge impact and potentially significantly affect our overall health in all of those other areas just by making that difference, those changes. So
absolutely. The holistic help is very, very important.
Catherine, were you going to say something?
I had one other question if I could. Elaine, you had suggested tracking your stress and your habits and all that. I find that in itself creates more stress. Any thoughts on how to track all those things while not like generating even more stress?
I hate to say it because every one of us, we're all so different. So there's probably a perfect way that you could do it that would minimize that stress impact. I know I was talking with one person just recently because I have a tracker that I always recommend, and I don't really care whether they use that tracker. It gives me access to information. So this one person was very stressed out by the fact that she had this printout and she had to fill out every box. And it's like, no, you don't have to. Just tell me what you feel comfortable with. And we ended up getting to a point where she's just texting me, you know, whatever information she can provide from whatever she feels comfortable with sharing for that day. And whether she shares it every day or shares it once, you know, a week, just whatever you feel comfortable with that doesn't cause more trouble. It's really interesting. You know, everybody is different. And so I really hate to say you absolutely need to do this because you don't absolutely need to do this, but it can be very revealing. I know like water is such an interesting conversation to start with because I think, I don't want to say 100%, but a large portion of people that I talk to, whether they're a client or it's the lady at the grocery store or the woman that cuts my hair or the man that I started a chat with at the gas station. I mean, everybody, you know, we're always talking about health in some way, shape or form, and water always seems to be the thing. It's like, oh, I get plenty of water. But then when they actually pay attention to what they drank 8 ounces, you know, and they might be, you know, a 250-pound man or something. So it's just, you know, tracking is something in whatever form you choose to do. It can be really, really revealing because we kind of have a perspective of what's going on and then reality is over here. So, and they don't necessarily meet or even cross over sometimes. So, but if you're in such a stressed state that that's just not going to work for you, then by all means, you know, find another way that is comfortable for you to do to gather the information that is helpful for you to solve that problem. You know, if you're dealing with a problem and your practitioner is really needing that information in order to answer questions, well, you know, maybe it is worth that form of stress in order to get that information. Like she was mentioning earlier about sometimes, you know, dealing with the expense of the Dutch test so you can get the information so you can start making the changes, you know, in a couple of weeks that will ultimately get you towards a healthier state quicker. It's the same with that. If, you know, if tracking that information is going to afford that practitioner the information that they need to give you the recommendations that will get you to a lower stress state, it might be worth it for that period of time. So that would be my suggestion.
Yep. I agree. And Rob, did you have another question? No. Okay. Did that answer your question, Catherine?
Yeah, I think part of it is, Elaine, your point on like even just texting, you know, whatever, makes me think of one of my issues, I think, is my perfectionist tendencies and my tendencies to like collect everything and track everything. And so I've got like 5 different trackers going. I've got Chronometer, I've got Fitbit, I've got this, I've got that. And so, you know, maybe just picking one or two and doing as well as I can, vice having to be perfect.
I just want to say, man, I commiserate, and it's just like I don't want to put a bullet in my head. It's like, what the hell? How much more do I do? It's like, no, I don't have enough days. There's not enough hours in the day. So it's kind of like, so Elaine, nice point taken. You know, it's just like a little bit is kind of better than nothing, you know, and it's kind of like, and shutting that part of our brain down, just tell that part of your brain to suck a mua, just go somewhere else. It's like farmer. It's like, it's really annoying. And I get that. Anyway, just had a pipe in there.
So, okay, great. Thank you all for all your lovely questions and all your engagement and wonderful presentation, Elaine. It was really, really informative, and the slides were beautiful. So thank you again. And I guess that's it. I guess our time is finished. So thank you everybody for coming. And next month we have another great topic. Do you have something you would like to say, Elaine? Or
I just wanted to say thank you for coming. Thank you for listening to me. And I appreciate the questions, and I hope you all have a wonderful day.
All right then. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.